Welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and promises it will never leave you again. I don't know what we were thinking. I'm so sorry. I'm so lucky to have you all. What were we doing? I'm Kevin Day, and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, it's lovely to be back, is it not?
It is indeed, Kevin. Absolutely splendid. Although Finlay is a bit grumpy because he's not had his walk yet this morning. We're recording at 10 o'clock on Sunday, so I got up at a silly o'clock to do a bit of... Well, there was a mind map to create, and that has to take priority.
Yes, yeah, so I saw the photograph of Finlay. To paragraph P.G. Woodhouse's opinion of Scotsman, it's very easy to differentiate between Finlay and a ray of sunshine this morning. I was quite heartened, Kieran, by all the "where are you" messages in week one, and then quite chilled that in week two, nothing. Just yes. Literally. No, they're not coming back then. But to you, Kieran... I've had a very interesting two-week break, and you've been lining up a special guest for us, haven't you, for our next pod?
Yes, I'm delighted to say that the fan-led review interim report by Tracy Crouch MP, which was sent to Oliver Dowden, was published earlier this week, and we've been in contact with Tracy, and she's coming on the show on Thursday. I was fortunate enough to speak to the fan-led review. You know, I was one of the many groups or individuals who did make a contribution. And as you know, I'm not party political, but the way that Tracy Crouch managed the proceedings was incredibly professional. And in my view, she's asking the right questions, and without going into detail for those people that have not read the report, It's absolutely brilliant.
Mm. Yeah, there's no doubt about it that she pulls no punches, and she asks some very difficult questions of her bosses, her own bosses. So I'm looking forward to talking to her. As you say, Kieran, you're one of the very many individuals invited to talk to the review. For me, it'll be the first time I've met her. So, because as always, the mature one gets asked to do these things. It's questions day, Kieran, but we have some news to catch on. Obviously, so it's going to be a sort of strange hybrid affair today to welcome everyone back. A strange hybrid affair is pretty much how Ali refers to our relationship. I'll tell you what, Kieran, let's pick up from where we left off with bad news for Newcastle fans. Mike Ashley looks like he's here for at least another season, and apologise to any Newcastle fans who think that may be good news.
Yes, so this is to do with the potential takeover of Newcastle United. The case in respect of where does the PIF lie in terms of, is it an independent organisation or is it controlled by the Saudi government? That has now been delayed until, and I quote, early 2022, due to, and again, to quote the exact words, issues with disclosure of evidence. Now, given that this has been rumbling on for at least a year, I'm not quite sure why they have to work out what the evidence is. It's either there or it's not, and it does seem strange that it's going to sort of gather dust. I think for those Newcastle fans that think it should go to court as opposed to arbitration, when we had Nick DeMarco QC on the show, he was very much of the view that arbitration was A, quicker and B, cheaper for all parties. So I think it is probably the right process. Amanda Staveley, who's heading up the consortium, her husband took to Twitter when this announcement took place. And I think reading between the lines, he's not impressed with the Premier League. Mm. Newcastle fans, to give them credit, they've been to Downing Street. They've petitioned outside in as is their democratic right to do so. So they're trying to increase the pressure and highlight the slow progress at which this is taking place. Biggest losers potentially is Newcastle United and their fans, because Mike Ashley is now in the position of a person who is planning to sell his house and therefore is doing the bare minimum in terms of maintenance. Mm. Therefore, you know, in terms of recruitment, planning, and player strategy, it's on life support at present.
Yeah, they've been noticeably quiet in the transfer market, and sometimes you don't know whether there is a sinister reason for that, or whether they're just one of those clubs that do their business late in the window or whatever. But it has been, and we're not the only people. Newcastle fans all over the world are picking up on the fact that there's not a lot of activity in terms of transfer wise. It might be worthwhile, Carl, I know I've only had a short break, but it might be worthwhile reminding people of a couple of the acronyms we use. So PIF?
The Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. Yeah. It is a sovereign wealth fund. It is used to invest in a variety of investments and projects, some of which are linked to sport, either directly or indirectly, but others are in other industries.
Yeah, I can virtually guarantee, Kieran, that at some stage in the next month or year, we will be talking about the PIF takeover of Newcastle United and wondering why it just didn't happen when it should have happened last year, because it seems very, very odd. And again, you know what football fans are like. In the absence of hard information, that's when the conspiracy theories start to spread and when fans get even more restless, isn't it? But, Kieran, we have good news for Swindon fans with their takeover happening. And again, apologies to any Swindon fans who think that's bad news. I don't think there will be many.
No. The good news, I think, from the perspective of the Swindon fan base who had initiated the No Power is campaign in respect of their owner, Lee Power, or former owner, is that the deal appears to have been done. The new owner, who is a guy called Clem Morfuni, who is based in Australia, I believe that he has now had the shares formally transferred to him by Lee Power against Lee Power's wishes.
Yeah.
There were stories that Lee Power had accepted a higher offer, having originally, it looks like he'd originally agreed to sell to Clem Morfuni. It's really good. The EFL seems to be positive about this as well. I'm delighted for one of the friends of the show who came on from the Swindon Supporters Trust, Rob Angus. He's now been appointed as the Chief Executive Officer of Swindon Town. Congratulations to Rob. I think there's sort of two issues which they're now sort of focusing on. Clearly, there's a recruitment a concern from the playing side of things. They're trying to purchase the ground back from the council and make this three things. That they've also got issues to do with their season tickets. They've set themselves a target of 6,000. There are some issues to do with refunds from previous seasons, because getting money out of Lee Power was proving to be difficult for not just players who went unpaid, but I think fans struggled as well. But there's a lot of goodwill towards the new owners, and we wish them all the best.
Yeah, and you know what will happen with Rob Angus? He was only too pleased to come and talk to us when he was the leader of the angry fans. Now we'll try and get hold of him. We'll go, his PA, he'll have a PA now. His PA will say, I'm sorry, the price of what? No, Rob can't possibly talk to people like you. But wonderful news for Swindon fans, Kieran, because they can clip you saying former owner Lee Power and use that as a ringtone, can't they? Just you going, former owner Lee Power. And again, it's one of those stories. It's like Wigan, we've been reporting on it from the start, which is pretty much all we can do. And this is a good outcome, isn't it? This is the outcome you predicted would be best for the club, and that's really good news. I do need to point out, and I'm not saying this just because we've been talking about Swindon, which is nearly in the countryside, but if you can hear a strange noise in the background, it's because for some reason one of my neighbours has bought a cockerel and some chickens, and the cockerel seems to be in South London. This is dawn for him. He wakes up about 10:15 in the morning and starts crowing, which everybody in the street thinks is probably a bad idea, because we've got some quite clever foxes around here who I think they just think, brilliant, we don't have to root through KFC boxes anymore. We've got one live. It's fantastic. So we have taken bets, the neighbours and I, as to how long it's going to be there. But in the meantime, you will hear a cock crowing for some considerable time. I was delighted. I thought I'd been overdoing it, Kieran. So I was really pleased when I found there was an actual cockerel.
Yes.
Ali's away looking after her mum. She kept saying, you stop drinking and then you won't hear cockerels. And then here's a cockerel. That'll be a Martin Sells review, wouldn't it? A Brazilian Super League breakaway project here, and this is an interesting story. A Brazilian Super League breakaway project is being funded by US private equity. So what's in it for them?
Yes. I was talking to a friend about private equity this morning, and he described them as being on the something-o-meter, 11 out of 10.
Oh, wow.
The first word, which I will not say for politeness purposes, involved four letters, should I say.
Yeah.
As far as Brazilian domestic football is concerned, it's a shambles.
Right.
The CBF, which is in charge of all Brazilian football for both the domestic and the international team, just focuses on the international team to the detriment of domestic football to such an extent, such that during the Copa America, there were matches taking place. Can you imagine Manchester United versus Chelsea during the Euros?
Right,
with United not being able to play Maguire and Shaw, and Chelsea being short of Mason Mount and so on. So the president, a guy called Rogério Caboccio, he is presently sort of on gardening leave following sexual harassment and bullying claims. It looks as if one of the former presidents is trying to run the place, despite the fact that he's subject to a lifetime ban from football, from FIFA, for corruption purposes. So there is genuine problems. Where money goes and who's in control of football is very unclear, to such an extent that if you take a look at the timetable for matches, if there's midweek games taking place in the Brazilian league, they now have to kick off at 9 o'clock, which is it's pretty damn late. I know they don't like getting up early in Brazil as a rule, but so they're kicking off at 9 o'clock, and the reason for that is that the local television companies don't like them kicking off earlier because they reduce the ratings of the soap operas. So it's clearly that there's a problem. It doesn't generate a lot of money, the domestic league, which is why the private equity companies are coming in, because they think that they can change things around. That the reason why there's such a talent drain of Brazilian football to Europe is all due to the fact that if the clubs haven't got money coming in, then they can't play wages. But it looks as if the first division of Brazilian football is going for this. But it now could appear, and this is something, if we track back to the formation of the Premier League, in hindsight, might have been a good idea. It now looks as if the top two divisions could be going in for this. And clearly, some of the problems in the EFL Championship are due to the fact that it's independent of the Premier League, and it hasn't been able to share in the spectacular growth of the Premier League. So it's one to watch. Potentially some people could make money out of this, and I suspect they will be already extremely rich individuals.
Yeah, two things, Kieran. I'm sure some Brazilians don't mind getting up early, so let's not all tweet in at once.
Yes.
Secondly, I was only half joking. I don't quite understand where the interest or the return on this investment will come, because I know some Brazilian teams attract huge domestic crowds, but in terms of overseas markets, I mean, it's not, despite the fact we all love watching Brazil, the nation, play football, there's not a great deal of demand for watching Brazilian domestic football around the world, is there? So I'm struggling to see where they would be able to make money here.
Well, the argument is the reason why there isn't a lot of interest in the Brazilian domestic game from a global perspective is that all the talent leg it to Europe.
Of course.
So if they manage to renegotiate the TV deals, and I think these new TV deals are due to expire in 2023 or 2024, with some new form of ownership of the domestic game, effectively separating it from the way that the Premier League runs the itself compared to the Football Association, which concentrates on England and grassroots, that they could sell the rights for a lot more money. And on the basis of that, they can afford to keep more of the players, which will generate interest because, the next Neymar could in theory play in the domestic game. I'm a bit like you. I'm a bit skeptical because I can't ever see the position that they would ever overtake the likes of La Liga and the Premier League, because these institutions have become so embedded in sort of a global psyche. You know, I wrote an article for Something Today, and there's only five countries in the world that don't get the Premier League TV rights, and we'll probably list those in the next Price of Football quiz.
That's interesting. Only five countries in the world don't watch Premier League football or don't have that. Well, wow, goodness me. Well, let's move on to I'm aware that regular listeners, those who have come back after our 2 week break, I know what their attention spans are like. We'll be thinking it's not just Newcastle. Come on, there are other clubs, and if you've got your money on Derby County, you've just won. Because we all thought we have to have a derby. Was that Finlay again?
That was, you said Derby County. He's been trained. He's been trained to pick up his ears and bark.
We gave producer Guy, who's a bit lightheaded from 2 weeks counting his money, but we said we have to have a derby story. But to be honest, the only derby story that really is prominent is the fact that they're not putting season tickets on sale, and that's not really for a financial reason, they claim, is it? It's more to do with COVID precautions.
Well, so they claim. Derby, as we know, are a unique football club in the sense that there are 91 clubs who account for footballers one method, and then there is the Derby way. And at present, as far as I'm aware, there are 91 clubs trying to desperately get hold of cash through selling season tickets, and Derby County are doing it the Derby way. So the argument that they have put forward is that it is COVID-related. They don't know how many tickets they'll be able to sell. They are rolling over season tickets from last season for people who paid them. And they're describing this as a free season ticket, which I don't quite see a rollover as being that. I'm a bit more concerned. I don't want to go into too much detail, but suffice to say that if you bought a season ticket using a credit card, it would be covered by Section 75 of the Consumer Credit Act. And if something went wrong at the club, then the credit card companies would be duly obliged to give you a refund. Now, it could be that the credit card companies, and this is speculation, this is not based on any knowledge, but the story that they gave to me just didn't make business sense. You know, if you need cash, you get cash and you sort it out later. It could be that the credit card companies have said, well, if you are going to sell season tickets, because of the precarious nature of your finances, we don't want to get involved with that because we'll potentially on the hook should have refunds have to be given later. I'm uncomfortable. I don't think this is good news for Derby fans. Yes, they will be able to buy tickets on a match by match basis. They did play against Manchester United recently, and 8,000 people were allowed in Pride Park, which is great. But they had to go effectively pay on the day or buy tickets a few days in advance. To me, this smacks of the credit card companies not having 100% confidence in what's happening at the club.
Oh, Lord. Well, that's another one to keep an eye on at Derby. And here's a name from the past. Fans of financial extravagance and club kit-coloured goldfish will be intrigued to hear that Peter Ridsdale has been elected onto the board of the English Football League.
Yes, this is as a result of three directors of the Football League leaving. Simon Pearce of Derby County left, and I quote, to focus on the running of his club. Yeah. One left because his side was relegated, and I think another moved from a Championship club to a League One club. So there were three vacancies. And Peter Ridsdale has been put on the board. Now, it has to be said, he was given 19 votes. So, you know, there's 24 clubs. It clearly, he must be popular. I spoke to somebody involved at board level at a Championship club. I said, just sort of give me the reasons why, because if you take a look at the Peter Ridsdale backstory, and you know, Leeds fans will be running their way through a set of rosary beads whilst I go through this. Leeds United went from being a pretty successful club, and Peter Ridsdale was the chairman of Leeds United for around about 5 or 6 years. And I've been through season by season. The first 3 or 4 years, their finances were okay. And then he effectively put everything on red at the casino, put the house on red, and it came up black. And he signed a lot of players. And the club lost an absolute fortune. And Leeds fans will say that this created the challenges that the club had. It went into administration, it was relegated, it didn't appear in the Premier League for 16 years. And for a club as big as Leeds United, that does seem very strange. The Leeds fans point at Peter Ridsdale, and you mentioned the fortune spent on the goldfish. Again, if people want to Google Seth Johnson and Leeds United, that's a story in itself. According to Peter Ridsdale, it was always somebody else's fault. But it was David O'Leary's fault. It was the players' fault who were signed. It was always somebody else's fault. And I do think he comes from the Trump playbook, because I did a little bit of background research, and I said, well, okay, I spoke to some people who are involved at board level at clubs, and somebody described him as belligerent and arrogant to the extent that when they're having these Zoom conversations, if he doesn't agree with what you say, he will just he will put up his phone and make it clear that he's texting other people on WhatsApp to slag you off. He is certainly, and I don't want to say that the EFL is turning into an authoritarian regime, but he is coming from the playbook of give us 25% of your money to the Premier League, get rid of parachute payments. Yeah. He's certainly parroting the party line with regards to that, and those people who want perhaps a more nuanced relationship with the Premier League are saying, well, we don't necessarily agree with that. But what concerns me most of all is that in 2012, Peter Ridsdale was given a 7.5-year ban from being a director of any company in the United Kingdom. Now, as you know, I used to work in the insolvency business, and we are duty bound to write to the government agencies to say that if a company goes into receivership, administration, or liquidation, whatever it happens to be, are there any issues that should be brought to the attention of the authorities in terms of a person's capability or appropriateness for being a director of a company? I worked with some people who were scamps is the politest way I can describe about them. I had one guy that ran a boating company, a boating holiday company, and when it went bust, we had 30 boats, and I did an inventory of them, and I wrote to the banks, and the bank sent me details, and they had mortgages for 95 boats. And I'm going, what the fingers is going on here? And it turns out that the chief executive of this company, the MD, had let's say he'd got a boat called Daisy. He'd gone to Barclays. He'd got a mortgage because, these boats are worth, they're narrow boats. They're worth quite a bit of money. He got that money from Barclays for, say, 30 or 40 grand. He then unscrewed the nameplate and put the name Clarabelle on it, went to Lloyd's and said, I've got this boat called Clarabelle. It's not got a mortgage on it. Will you lend me 30 grand? And he kept doing this. There are some real scoundrels around. I wrote to, Brief said, well, this is pretty naughty behavior. And he didn't get a ban, although he did emigrate to Bolivia halfway through the time I was trying to run his company, and we never saw him again. People do not get bans often. 7.5 years is up there with some of the naughtiest people. Ken Anderson, who was the absolute wrong'un that was in charge of Bolton Wanderers, and just read the administrator's report in terms of their dealings with Ken Anderson. He was also banned for 8 years, so only slightly more than Peter Ridsdale. So, okay, were they being harsh on Peter Ridsdale? So we look up to see what happened. Ridsdale was in charge of a company called WH Sports Group Limited. That was effectively a consultancy company which gave advice to football clubs, and he paid £347,000 that was due to the company into his personal bank account. A mistake that can easily be made. I'm sure, producer Guy has this problem practically every day.
Also, when you've got that sort of money, you wouldn't notice 347,000 quid, would you? It's just like,
that's right.
I've had a refund for something, you'd think, yes.
Let's say mistakes were made. The company went into liquidation. He failed to tell the liquidator that he had made this payment when the liquidator was doing the investigation. There was also a failure to pay tax on profits, on staff, of £450,000. He failed to submit accounts for 3 years. And people say, why do I kick up such a fuss about those clubs that are constantly late about submitting their accounts? In the wider scheme of things, we love football because we love football. It's things like this. These are red flags. There was all of that, and yet, on the basis of that, straight from the Trump playbook, because Donald Trump's been, his record in terms of solvency is pretty poor, but blaming everybody else, being belligerent, is the way to get people to believe in you, and this appears to have worked at the EFL. I've said before, I feel that there are conflicts of interest, because another one of the directors, Jez Moxey, he is running a company which is offering advice and is trying to organise buyers and sellers for football clubs. Nothing wrong with that, but if you're on the board of the EFL, to me, that looks like a conflict of interest. And if the EFL, who I think have made some really positive steps in the course of the last couple of months, they are being far more transparent, and I applaud them for that. You've got to be seen to be doing the right thing at all levels. And it's all right. We're saying, the website's fine, but we've got people on the board who, it's a bit like saying, the captain of the Titanic, let's give him a second chance with another boat. If you've done what you've done at Leeds and these issues in terms of £347,000 being diverted into a personal bank account, I don't think that reflects particularly well.
No. You okay now? You want to take 30 seconds to breathe out now?
sorry, was it going on a bit?
No, it's all right. It was all very good. I feel on a bound to mention that you, of course, now have a fleet of boats called the Baroness moored around the back of your house. The Peter Ridsdale thing, it's interesting to hear you talk about Peter Ridsdale in that terms, because I used to host a live sports show on Radio 5 a long time ago, and Peter Ridsdale's image then was a kind of, idiot uncle just splashing the cash rather than, like you say, evil and manipulative. And we had a weekly quiz about him, three extravagances, which of these didn't happen. And the running joke was they all happened, basically. And it was the bit that made me laugh the most was the £80 a week on goldfish food. Not on fish, just on food. No. £80 a week on goldfish food, yes. And he had specially bred white goldfish in the colours of the... It would have been cheaper to change Leeds' kit. But, yeah. A couple of quick stories, Kim, as we do have some questions which I want to get through, which I think now we'll have to answer more briefly than we were planning to. Jadon Sancho is now the second most expensive English player of all time behind Harry Maguire, at £73 million. What do we know about this deal? Is there anything special about it? Is the money up front? Is it amortised?
I think it's a good deal for Manchester United. It's a reasonable deal for the selling club. They would have got 30 or 40 million more last season, but I think United have done well here. United have the money. despite all of the, and we've both praised and criticised the Glazer regime, we've criticised the Glazer regime, but we've praised many of the people at Manchester United who have done very good things for Manchester. I think it's market value. I'll be honest, if Brighton are getting 50 million for Ben White, then Jadon Sancho at 73 doesn't seem excessive.
Absolutely, yeah. And I warn any Palace fans listening now that if anyone, when he comes to Sellers Park, if anyone boos him for missing a penalty in the Euros, they will face the wrath of many people. Yeah. Don't do it. And finally, this is an interesting one. Steve Dale has inadvertently done something good for Bury, and he's going to be furious about this, isn't he?
Yes, this is absolutely fantastic. Steve Dale sued Bury AFC for the use of the football club crest, to which he claimed that he had rights. And he lost the case, and he had to go and pay a fine on the back of that. And Bury AFC, fantastic of them, they've used this money to give to some supporters who are not in good financial circumstances as season tickets for the forthcoming season. So, this is assuming that Steve Dale has actually paid that amount. Yeah, he's been told to, and Steve Dale has been told to do many things by courts over the years. It doesn't necessarily move the dial in terms of his bank account. So, I'm sure he's absolutely fuming at this, and I'm all the more delighted for it.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yeah, and it just couldn't be a starker contrast between the approaches of two different groups of people, is it really? That, you know, he tried to sue them for using a club crest, which was based on the club's, the town's crest anyway, and the club he tried to sue are using the money he's had to pay to buy season tickets for people who can't afford it. So we another indication of whose side we're on. So, look, Kieran, let's have some questions.
Sure.
God knows what our 2-week break has done to the stockpile, although Guy was at great pains to tell me this week it's a virtual stockpile, he said. It's not like porn mags under his mattress, which was a strange analogy, I thought.
Yeah.
I think he thought I was worried that this big pile of paper questions was getting higher and higher. But anyway, let's crack through some of these questions. Luke Thurston asked us a 3-part question, but I've chosen the last part for time purposes because I think it's quite an interesting question. Very interesting, in fact. Can a player take legal action with betting companies to stop them using their name for things like first goal scorer gambling if they're against betting in general?
I don't think so, because in terms of intellectual property, the player might be able to claim that his or her signature or likeness can be trademarked and registered and therefore protected. But the name itself, I think, would be more of a challenge, because if you've got a name like, you know, let's take Jake Harrison at no not or what's his name Harrison.
Well, there'll be a Jake Harrison somewhere.
Jake Harrison. Let's say if your name's Jake Harrison, there are more than one Jake Harrisons around.
Of course.
So therefore, and we saw the problems that Liverpool Football Club had when their owners, who again aren't on our good books, they tried to trademark the word Liverpool. As somebody that works at the University of Liverpool, I said, well, you know, If that went through, does that mean we have to pay Liverpool Football Club every time we say, you know, we send out a prospectus? So that was rejected. So I think the players would struggle. Where we had Ibrahimovic falling out with FIFA was that they were using his likeness and his name, and he was therefore he was in a position to protect them. But I don't think you'd be able to do it with betting, because if you think about what the betting companies do on a broader thing, they have books for who's going to be the next prime minister, who's going to win Love Island. Not that I watch Ireland, Love Island, but as a result of me watching the Euros every single night, that the Baroness has now taken control of the remote in our house, and I'm going, I thought that a 0-0 draw between Poland and Hungary was boring. This is just beyond belief.
Tempted to suggest that the reason we had a 2-week break was so you could go out and take part in Love Island, but I think that would have been stretching credulity. And I know
it's not got to Moscow yet, Kevin.
It's not an island. Plenty of love involved, but there's no. I know why you chose Jake as your fictional footballer, because our next question comes from a Jake Foster. And Jake Foster says, in 2008, Gillingham took out a bank loan of £10 million, but in 2018, it was written off. How can a bank just write off a debt like that? Good question, Jake.
Yes. I suspect I was the only person at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning going to Company's House to take a look at Gillingham Football Club's old accounts from 2008. I couldn't find a loan. And I've looked at all of the accounts since 2008, and I still can't find a loan. But to answer it theoretically, how could a bank write it off? There's two things. First of all, they could have done an asset swap. So, for example, they could have said, we've given you a loan, and now we're going to write off the loan, and we're going to take your ground. We're going to take your property. So it could do an asset swap. Or they could have converted the loan into shares. And that's what we see with some club owners, for example. So that's what could have happened theoretically. I think neither of those actions would have been logical from a bank's point of view. You know, if I'm a shareholder in HSBC and I'm looking at the list of subsidiaries, and you've got, you know, this bank here in Switzerland, in the US and Canada and so on, and then Gillingham Football Club, I'd be going, what? And also converting into shares, there's no way that the local bank would want to get involved with that, because that means that in theory they can appoint the directors, who can appoint the manager, who can sign the players, and it can only end in tears.
Okay, Ivan Knoll has an interesting take. Ivan said, I was just wondering if it's possible that a small club like Crawley Town could actually have been better off last season behind closed doors. Not a huge amount of money coming in on the gate on a weekly basis anyway, but they had player sales and the FA Cup run. So that's quite an interesting take, isn't it?
Yes. So if we take a look at Crawley Town's accounts, they did make £500,000 profit in 2020. So fair play to that. And that was on the basis of both their FA Cup success and player transactions. The vast majority of clubs have suffered losses. The losses of the top two divisions. We're still awaiting Newcastle's accounts. We're recording this on Sunday. Palace's accounts have been sent to Company's House. They're still in the photocopier, waiting to be actually put out. And it is genuine. They actually have to go through a scanner before they are put out by Company's House itself, which is so old school. It makes you proud to be British.
A scanner? Is this like the transfer window fax? You still have to fax people. Yes. Why do they have to go through a scanner? What are these?
I don't know. I'll have to talk to some people at the Company's House to say why can't you just ping through instantly?
You see what I've done now? The Baroness is going to be so unhappy with me because I've given you an excuse to go to Company's House. I'm sorry, darling. Kevin asked a really important question. I need to be at Company's House to find out why they're...
That could be our summer holiday this year, Kevin. The way things are going. Boy, am I going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Ivan is absolutely right in the sense that practically every club lost money. The most profitable club in English football in 2020, I'll give you three guesses. I think this is a I don't think you'll come anywhere near, but just out of curiosity.
Well, I was going to say Derby County for just for shits and giggles. All right, let's. Okay, oh, crikey. Okay, well, it's not going to be in the Championship, is it?
Or
the
Certainly not.
Or the Premier. Oh, Ipswich Town.
No. They lost 8-0.
Oh, okay. I don't know. We could be here all day. Will I?
Okay. Yeah. Sheffield United.
Oh. Okay.
And the reason for this, it's first season syndrome.
Right.
In the Premier League, you go up with the Championship squad, and yes, they'll get pay rises, but they won't get massive pay rises. So for your first season in the Premier League, you tend to make money. And also, they had an absolutely fantastic season, 2019-20. So they got a lot more prize money. So they are the most profitable club in English football in 2019, well, and Scottish football as well. The reason why clubs are losing money, and I looked at Scottish football as well when I was sort of doing the background for this, is that Crawley did make a wee bit of profit. Most of the other clubs in lower leagues lost money. But when you then look at Scottish football, most of the clubs in lower league Scottish football have broken even or have made a small profit. So there must be a reason before this. And the reason why is that in Scottish football, you've got slopes between divisions. You know, the difference between the bottom of the Premiership and the top of the Championship and the bottom of the Championship and the top of Division One are actually relatively small. Whereas in English football, we've got cliffs.
Yeah.
And the trouble is you're either spending money you don't have to try to go from the bottom of the cliff to the top, or you're spending money and putting the club at risk to avoid relegation because you don't want to go from the top of the cliff to the bottom. And this is why I've always argued in respect of parachute payments is that parachute payments aren't the problem. The cliffs are the problem. And if you make that cliff a more gentle slope, then we can get rid of parachute payments because they there's no doubt they distort football, but they also stop clubs from going bust.
One of the many issues we'll be talking to Tracy Crouch about on Thursday. But also, we've got an interesting question coming up about Scottish football, which I'm actually very intrigued to hear your answer to. But before that, we have a question from Marty Laidler. Probably the most pugnacious start to a question since we've been doing this pod. And Marty Laidler, and I quote, says, "This is a question from a Sunderland supporter born in Middlesbrough, now living in Melbourne, pronounced Melbourne, not Melbourne."
Well, that put me to rights, didn't it?
Well, it did. But Marty, I'm just going to put this out there. According to my mate born in Chester, now living in Melbourne, he's going to carry on calling it Melbourne. And he says, he says, when your lockdown is lifted, he's arranged to meet in an underground car park for a straightener. But in the meantime, Marty says, and it's a good question, and it's asking for some detail on something we talk about a lot. He says, we hear a lot of discussion about the Premier League and the fact that 14 clubs can force decisions through. But what kind of business entity is the Premier League? Do the new teams every season have to sign on as shareholders? And is there a scenario where a relegated club decides it doesn't want to relinquish control?
Yeah, it is an intriguing one. Well, the Football Association Premier League Limited is a company in its own rights. It's effectively got 21 shares, one of which is owned by the Football Association, but is never used for voting purposes. Yeah, that sort of gentleman's agreement.
Right.
But it could do. It could do in theory. And the other 20 shares are owned, each one is owned by a club. And this is one of the rules that the people behind Project Big Picture, you know, the Glazers, Rick Parry and the people at Liverpool, FSG, that's the rule they wanted to change. They wanted to have rights which just gave them the ability to have the votes and therefore make decisions. And under the Constitution, okay, you have to go to something called the Articles of Association of the Football Association Premier League Limited.
Yeah.
It specifically states that upon relegation, the club must relinquish its share. It doesn't have a choice. So failure to do so would be a breach of rules. It would be subject to sanction, which could involve being expelled from the Premier League. So there's no rational reason why a club would do that. And then those shares are automatically transferred to the three clubs that are being promoted. And if you go to Companies House,
And you look up something called a confirmation statement, and that should be published in the next week or two. You will see a new confirmation statement, and that lists the individual shareholders. So therefore, the fans of Watford, Norwich and Brentford, and welcome, you know, as the 50th club in the Premier League to Brentford, their names will be up as shareholders. Mm. So that's how that works. So I think a club trying to play silly buggers with the rules would not get very far. And also, if they did try that, and even if they dragged things out, what good it would do them when under the Premier League constitution, you need 14 votes to get anything through. So even if they tried to, what could easily happen was that the other 19 clubs in the Premier League, I suspect, backed by the Football Association, would pass a motion to say, this club, whoever it is never allowed back in the Premier League.
Mm. Now, that's interesting. I didn't know that. That's the 21st share is very interesting as well, that the FA choose not to use.
They're a bit like your mum and dad sort of saying, yeah, you go and sort out which film you want to go and watch at the cinema. We'll drive you there. We won't interfere.
Yeah, you never met my mum and dad, did you? the Scottish question. The Scottish question. If only we could answer the Scottish question on this pod. The Scottish question comes from Ross Petrie, and I can't tell you how happy one day I'll be when we get a question about Scottish football from somebody called Ross County. But Ross, I apologise if you've heard that joke before. Of course you have. But Ross makes a really intriguing point. Ross Petrie says, could you tell us if a merger of clubs in Scottish football like Dundee and Dundee United or Hearts and Hibs would make them more of a competition for the old firm and make the league more competitive? Now, Ross, seriously, I should point out that it kicked off badly enough when Robert Maxwell tried to merge Oxford and Reading. Can you imagine the fuss when someone tried to say, we're going to have a club called Hibs of Midlothian?
yes.
But financially, though, Kieran, would that make sense? I mean, because we hear about all sorts of issues to make Scottish football more competitive, but merging two rival clubs isn't one that's come up before.
No, and I think for, you know, historic cultural reasons, there's probably a very good reason for that. But looking at things, setting the rivalries domestically aside, you know, because clearly the fans of both sets of clubs don't necessarily get particularly well on. If we take a look at the scorecard in Scottish football, Celtic have revenues of 70 million, Rangers had 59, so this is for 2020. Hearts and Hibs and Aberdeen are third on 14. So there's a huge gap. You know, people say, why do these clubs dominate Scottish football? Well, money dominates football because there's a huge correlation between wages and transfer spend. Success and between them, Celtic and Rangers have, I think it was 96.5% of the total spend of all four divisions.
Wow.
In Scottish football. So yeah, they really blow everybody else out of the water. If Hearts and Hibs together were combined, their revenues would go to 22 million. So they would be the third biggest club. They would certainly leap over Aberdeen. And what could be a game changer is that if they got into the Europa League, I'm sure they'd love to get into the Champions League as well, but if they got into European football and got into the group stages, that could be significant from a financial point of view. And that could certainly creep them up the dial a lot further. So Hearts and Hibs combo, it would take time, but I think they're, you know, conceptually, setting aside the fact that this has got no chance of happening, that they could potentially be a competitor. If we take a look at Dundee and Dundee United, I would say not, because even if you combine the two sets of revenues, it only comes to 8 million. Yeah, right. Even if they've got some sort of economies of scale on that, they're not really going to be. So, you and I are both old enough to remember Dundee United under Jim McLean and their incredible achievements. And I think this just goes to show the guy was a bit of a genius.
What about if these clubs, and this is something I have mentioned in Edinburgh before, I won't do it again because it was clearly a mistake saying it out loud. I can't tell you how sad I am not to be in Edinburgh for a second year running. But if Hearts and Hibs or Dundee and Dundee United were to share a ground, for example, would that financially help in any way, shape or form? Because we're the only country that seems to get really fixated on the idea that you have to have two grounds 50 yards apart. You know, in Italy, teams will happily share grounds. I know they're different historical cultural reasons, but would that help them financially?
There would be some financial benefits. You've not got two sets of maintenance. You only need one. You know, you don't need two sets of groundsmen. Repairs and renewals. Yeah, so some cost would be reduced. You'd be playing there twice. Once a week instead of once a fortnight. So. Yes, there would be a small financial benefit, but the most significant costs for football clubs are player related in terms of wages and transfer fees, as opposed to costs relating to the key infrastructure assets.
Mm. We've still got one or two questions left, Kieran. Our last question, I suspect, will take a couple of minutes. So let's see if we can run through the next two or three fairly quickly. And the first one comes from Ronif Nair, who said there was an article recently in The Athletic on Pedro Gonçalves and his transfer from Wolves. It said that when Wolves sold him to Famalicão, they inserted a sell-on clause on his next two transfers. He was then sold to Sporting, at which point they got a cut. And if Sporting sell him, Wolves get a cut of that too. How can that be, considering there's no contract between Wolves and Sporting? Well, that makes, if they got in a cut on two transfers, I think that makes two transfers. But Ronif has a point. There's no deal between Wolves and Sporting Lisbon, so how do Wolves get money?
No, well, Wolves would get money from Famalicão, which could be a huge risk for Famalicão. Yeah, because Gonçalves is now being described as the next Bruno Fernandes, and right. he is certainly being monitored by the senior clubs in Europe. And this is not to denigrate Sporting, as a big club themselves, but Portugal is the biggest exporter of players in Europe. This will have been baked into the contract between Wolves and Famalicão, who I presume themselves have got a sell-on clause in respect of this player with Sporting. Because if they haven't, they're opening themselves. Yeah, what happens if he is a fantastic tournament at the World Cup next year and all of a sudden goes for 80 to 100 million? Yeah, they could be really left on the hook unless they've covered their backsides in terms of the sale of the player to Sporting.
Oh, you've really depressed me mentioning the World Cup. It's bad enough having an Olympics that I can't take any interest in, but I already know for a fact that the Qatar World Cup is going to pass me by.
The Olympics, I would say, are great. I was watching the cycling this morning, and it made me fall in love with sport. Remember, the last time we spoke was before the Euro finals, and I think we've both been pretty flat in terms of our love of the game since then. In terms of the obscene behaviour of a small group of people, it has to be said, in terms of the reaction to the players who didn't take the penalties and the general bellendery of people who were trying to get into watch the game. But the innocence of sport and has been rekindled for me just watching some of the Olympics. Those sports you've got no interest in. How often do we use the word repercharge, Kevin, in everyday life?
It's true. I know. During the last Olympics, I found myself in a pub in Edinburgh going mad about dressage, which is strange. I just feel so, my heart breaks for all those athletes who unfortunately couldn't make it last year. There's that poor judo lad this year, their whole lifetime ambition heading towards an Olympics, and there's no one there to watch them. It's just heartbreaking. But they know that better than we do. Dhruv Garg has a question about a subject we talk about a lot. So I think you can probably answer this quite quickly, but he takes it to extremes, but he's right though. Dhruv says, we know certain clubs who shall not be named don't submit accounts on time. Could the EFL not bring in a rule that failure to do so would bring an automatic points deduction?
Right. Let's go back to the EFL. The EFL ultimately is a members club and the members set the rules. The only thing preventing this from taking place
is an agreement at the next EFL meeting.
Right.
Somebody could propose it. If it gets enough votes, it will be passed. Again, credit to the EFL where it's due. They are now putting through transfer embargoes for those clubs that are late with the accounts, mentioning no names, but Derby County. It has resulted in an improvement in terms of submission of data. And I'm all in favour of that.
Yeah, I can't wait to see Palace's accounts next year. Suddenly spending loads of money on the young people. It's just heady times. You say you've fallen out of love with football. It took me 3 days before we signed someone, and then I was back in love again. Phil Chater, again, this is an issue we've spoken about before, but Phil Chater says, we recently heard that Peterborough's Bobby Copping had to retire from football through injury at just 19 years of age, which is heartbreaking again. How will this be dealt with financially from the club and players' point of view?
Right. From the club's point of view, if they had paid a fee for the player and it was being amortised, then they would have to write off all of the fee following the decision of Bobby Copping to retire early. And having read the story, it is truly heartbreaking. This is a young man. He'd come from Bury Football Club and he suffered a head injury,
yeah,
a very severe head injury.
Yeah.
Credit to Peterborough United as an institution. They have now given him a job in the academy. So he's still in the world of football, except he can't do the thing which he set his heart on as a young man, as a career. But at least he's still within the sport. As far as the individual is concerned, he might have a personal insurance policy which would pay out critical injury, as could the club in terms of the remainder of his contract. So there could be some form of financial settlement as a result of that. But yeah, without knowing personal circumstances, and ultimately, they're none of our business. We can't go any further than that.
Yes, it's no consolation to the young man at present, but there's been several stories recently of coaches that had to retire from the game earlier on who are now doing brilliant work at Premier League clubs as coaches and trainers. So hopefully that lies in Bobby Copping's future. Our final question, Kieran, is a very interesting, I think it's a theoretical one, but I'm not entirely sure. It's from Aidan Grant, who's a friend of the show. And Aidan said, on a recent pod, you said the overwhelming majority of clubs are losing money. Now, given that money in circulation is a constant, etc., that must surely mean that someone somewhere is making the same amount of money. I appreciate that clubs lose money, tax, VAT, etc., but is there a rough estimate of down whose plug hole that money flows each year? Now, the etc. in money in circulation, etc., is doing a lot of hard work there, Kieran.
Yes.
And I also now intend to see if I can sell a TV show called Down Whose Plug Hole. Because I would definitely watch a show called Down Whose Plug Hole. But it's a good question, Kieran, because the money's going somewhere, and money in circulation is a constant. So if somebody's losing it, somebody's getting it, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, I'm still thinking of this TV. I've got a scenario in my head, and I'll discuss it with you after the show.
Well, I see you as the kind of Susie Dent in Dictionary Corner of Down Whose Plug Hole. I'll be the host, and then every now and again I'll throw to you and I say, whose plug hole is this? and then I'll say, if you could not mention Moscow, that would be great.
Yes.
Because I know that's why you started giggling when I said plug hole. So childish. Yeah.
What Aidan is bringing up is the idea of what we call in economics a zero-sum game. Ultimately, there must be so much money in the world and it's circulating around. So it cannot grow or contract to a certain extent. So where are these losses going? Well, I took a look at the collective sets of accounts of clubs in the Premier League, with the exception of Newcastle United, who have not submitted any.
Let it go. Yeah.
Well, yeah. If Mike Ashley wants transparency, then perhaps Mike Ashley should be transparent.
Fair enough. I agree.
And the biggest deficit, and the Premier League clubs are losing. Yeah, we are talking hundreds upon hundreds of millions of pounds, but they collectively had a deficit to other clubs in Europe in terms of transfers of around about £800 million. So
Crikey.
Where is the money from the Premier League going in terms of losses? It's going to Portugal, it's going to France, it's going to Italy and Spain and so on. So that's one thing. The other place where the football industry is losing money to is other parts of the football industry in the form of players. If we take a look at the Championship, for example, for every £100 in 2019-20 that clubs in the Championship generated, they paid out £123 in wages. So, you know, the money has gone to other parts of football, be it players or alternatively other clubs within Europe. So that's the overall calculations of the numbers.
It's lovely to be back, Kieran, and it's lovely to be able to say to people, if you have questions for our next pod or our next questions pod, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. If you have questions for Tracy Crouch, who will be interviewing on our next pod on Thursday, please send those to the same address. And it's even more lovely, Kieran, to be able to say, after a two-week break, which felt much longer, I shall hand over to Mr. Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, first of all, folks, I think on behalf of myself and Kevin, we were genuinely touched at the number of people who said that they were missing us.
Yep.
You know, if only our wives had the same attitude towards us, that would be absolutely wonderful. They said, "Oh, you're not still in that room, are you?" Is the attitude of the Baroness.
Do you know what? I'm not entirely sure my mother-in-law is ill. I just think Ali's gone to Birmingham for as long as she could stay up there.
If you do like the show, if you could press on the follow button, hit those icons for either Spotify or Apple, and most importantly, if you know, we've got Patreon for as little as £1 a month, you can support the show, but you don't have to. You know, if you just say nice things about us, it makes a difference. If you put those on the Apple app. The Apple Podcast app, because they make a genuine impact in terms of where we are in terms of the league tables. And you know, we are a niche show. We're not trying to compete against Peter Crouch and so on. But you know, one of the reasons why Tracy Crouch was prepared to come on the show was that she did her homework and she looked at the reviews. And you know, we are genuinely grateful for the nice things you say about the show. We do put a lot of effort into trying to put it together and to answering your questions and so on. And it allows us to have a bit more credibility when we're talking to people such as Tracy and also people in the football industry when we're trying to get guests. So apart from that, thanks very much. And we'll see you soon with Tracy Crouch on Thursday. And it's a show we're both really excited about and really looking forward to.
Indeed. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.